Support for WPR comes from Focus on Energy. Committed to helping Wisconsinites focus on the planet by making smart energy choices. Energy resources for Earth Day and every day can be found at focusonenergy.com. Support for WPR comes from the American Society of Landscape Architects Wisconsin Chapter. Dedicated to reimagining the design of outdoor spaces for the well-being of all. Examples at wiasla.com.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll take a look at what Congress is up to this week, including House and Senate votes on the debt ceiling.
First, the Archdiocese of Milwaukee says it's filing its bankruptcy reorganization plan. It released it earlier today. According to church officials, the plan includes $4 million for child sexual abuse victims.
The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports that if approved, it would be by far the smallest sexual abuse settlement by any Catholic Church bankruptcy of this size filed to date.
Joining us now is Chuck Quirnbach, WPR's reporter in Milwaukee, who's covering the story today. Chuck, welcome back to the show.
Good afternoon.
So, Chuck, briefly, how did we get to this situation today with this bankruptcy reorganization plan?
Well, of course, the Archdiocese declared bankruptcy about 3 years ago, just over 3 years ago, and there's been a long court fight in federal court, bankruptcy court, over the details, how many people would be included, what the creditors would get, whether people should be excluded, and so on. And we've finally come today where the Archdiocese has proposed a reorganization plan.
We mentioned the $4 million of settlement money in the intro. Who would get that money? What would it go for?
Well, part of the money would go towards helping the victims deal with their lives and make adjustments and so on. There would also be some money separate from that to go to a therapy fund, and there would also be an attempt to help the victims sue the church's insurance companies to get more money from the insurance companies. The church is insured, obviously, on these things like this, and there's been a battle back and forth between the church and its insurance companies at times. The Archdiocese is promising to help folks make headway against the insurance companies.
I think a lot of people were watching for what that number was going to be, but what are other key parts of the bankruptcy reorganization plan?
Well, that seems to be the main focus of it. I mean, all of the other archdioceses that have settled around the country, and there's been 6, 7, or 8 or so, there have been much higher amounts. The dollar amount for the victim seems to be the main focus. Now, this one also includes an invitation for the victims to come, chat with the Archbishop, Jerome Listecki, and discuss things. And as I say, this sort of this long-term therapy promise. But, it's controversial.
Now, the group SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, held a press conference this afternoon. You were there. What was their response, especially to that amount of money?
Quite critical. The press conference was still going on a few moments ago. The terms that were used by some of the speakers include tragic. One person that had been sexually abused as a child suggested this was like being abused again. This time the Archdiocese, and with the dollar amount it offered, so quite critical. I think the victims' groups will try to encourage bankruptcy judge Susan Kelly, who will be getting this reorganization plan, to not accept it. That there should be more in the way of financial compensation and other things. As I say, the quite strong remarks from the SNAP group this afternoon.
And for the Archbishop's part, how did he present the plan and that amount of money with the knowledge probably that this was not a large amount of money compared to other settlements around the country?
Well, he's told WPR and others that no amount is going to make everyone happy. So he's sort of saying this is what they have. He's also suggesting they would have to go into debt to come forward with this money. The critics of the Archdiocese say there's been a long battle over a multi-million-dollar cemetery trust fund that the victims want opened up to potentially, to be divided among some of the victims. There's also the issue of whether parish money is separate from the Archdiocese. The Archdiocese, I think, has argued that the parishes are separate. And so there's a bigger pool out there that the victims would like, to which victims would like access.
You mentioned the judge in this case. What is next? What's the timeline for a decision on whether this plan can go ahead?
Well, we don't quite know the timetable. As I say, we're 3 years in. I don't think it's going to be that long before it's resolved, but it might be a few weeks. I think there are other creditors that would like, from the archdiocese, that would like to know what it means for them. Finally today, the victims were saying, the first they learned of this was on a commercial conservative talk radio program this morning, that the archdiocese never met with them to say, well, this is what we're going to announce tomorrow, what do you think, anything like that. It was a total surprise to the victims, and that has rubbed salt in the wounds as well.
So the Archbishop called this a major step toward ending the bankruptcy, returning the church's focus to the primary mission of the church. But I know we can't predict the future, but it seems like it's going to be a while before things are back to normal for the Archdiocese.
Well, and the victims suggest that the longer the church takes on this matter, that the church is losing registered members, at least in the Milwaukee area. The victims say this has a long-term damage, sort of a self-inflicted wound that the church is doing, and that the longer things drag out, that the more harm that will be done to the church. Now, of course, in any negotiations, there's often back and forth, so we'll see if Judge Kelly does not accept this agreement. The victims are saying we might go to federal appeals court, probably be down in Chicago, and there might be judges in other states that would be see things differently. So, yes, this could go on a while if the victims don't get an amount closer to what they want. And they declined today at the news conference to say exactly what dollar figure would make them whole. They just pointed out how small this was, this $4 million offer was in comparison to other bankruptcies around the country.
Chuck, thanks a lot for covering this and joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Chuck Kornbach, our WPR reporter in Milwaukee.
It's time now to turn our focus to Washington for our weekly spotlight on Congress. Yesterday, the House voted to increase the debt limit with a clean, no-strings-attached bill, and the Senate approved that plan earlier today. After frequent debate during the past couple of years, it will now be a year before Congress debates that limit again.
Also, with a dangerous ice storm hitting the South today, the Senate held a panel on extreme weather preparedness to talk about the role that the federal government can play in dealing with situations like that Atlanta shutdown a couple weeks back. USA Today's Congress and Politics editor Paul Singer joins us every Wednesday at this time to share his thoughts on what's going on in Congress. He tweets from @SingerNews. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Great. Thanks for having me again.
A lot of drama on the debt ceiling this week. It wasn't quite a sure thing in the House yesterday, was it?
No. We were watching the numbers as the people are voting. We're like, okay, they need about 10 more. They need about 12 more. But they did get over the hump, and the House did pass it. What was interesting is that it passed almost entirely on Democratic votes. There was only, I think, 28 or 29 Republican votes for this debt ceiling increase, including the Speaker of the House, John Boehner.
What does this mean for Speaker Boehner? And he could have put the kibosh on this whole thing, right, and not allowed a vote at all.
Yeah, he could have. But then, of course, he'd be wearing that debt default around his neck if America went into some sort of economic disaster. In fact, I think, even as we speak, they have just posted my analysis of this whole thing, that John Boehner ends up being the big winner here because he gets the debt ceiling issue off the plate for the rest of the year.
Mm-hmm.
The federal government funding has already been resolved for the rest of the year. And so between now and the 2014 elections, basically Boehner is not in jeopardy of having the House completely mess up the government and therefore completely mess up Republican election hopes in 2014.
Okay, but isn't he wearing the clean debt ceiling increase that members of his own party didn't want around his neck for letting that happen?
Yes, he is. However, the good news for him on that front is that then he can say, well, yeah, but this is all paying for old bills, and it's because the Democrats refused to cut spending, and we couldn't get it through the Senate anyway, and there's no point barking up a tree if we don't have the votes to pass it. So this just proves why we need more Republicans in Congress.
And I'd seen headlines and emails from conservative groups using the word surrender, referring to House Republicans.
Well, And that's the thing, is that amongst the Tea Party, they see this as a surrender or a traitorous sellout. You know, they basically said, they said 6 months ago, and then, and Boehner had said a year ago, we're going to make some demands on a debt ceiling. We're not going to raise a debt ceiling until we get some offsetting cuts. And they didn't get them. And that is a significant compromise. But again, for Boehner's position, he may be best off losing on this issue, as it were, getting this issue done and over with for the rest of the year, and then letting the Tea Party groups and other Republicans go to the floor of the House the rest of the year and complain and call for, you know, deeper cuts, because that's the message they want the party to run on in November.
Do you reckon that any of the Republicans who voted for that increase could face a primary challenge still this year?
Well, oddly enough, one of the Republicans that voted for it, a guy named Gary Miller from California, announced today that he's retiring at the end of the year. Mm. So solve that.
He was
problem.
Safe.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, today in the Senate, there was a really interesting chapter of this where it was not clear the Senate was going to pass this thing either. And then Senator Mitch McConnell stepped forward, the Republican leader, and voted for it. And that is where you get an interesting primary challenge, because he's already got a Tea Party group attacking him for being too moderate. He's got a Tea Party challenger in his Republican primary for re-election in Kentucky. And that was a tough swallow for Mitch McConnell, go to the floor and basically provide the momentum to get the debt ceiling bill to the floor.
Well, let's talk about some of the drama on the Senate floor. As I understand it, this is just a little while ago today, there was an attempt at a filibuster. Is that right?
Well,
or a delay.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to phrase it. You know, the Senate has gone so past normal procedure. I mean, the way this works is there's two votes in the Senate. There's one to bring the bill to the floor, and then the second to pass the bill. And that one, to bring the bill to the floor, requires 60 votes. And there was a question whether anybody was going to stand up and object, and nobody did, but they couldn't get the 60 votes. So for about an hour, we were sitting here watching the TV and watching the senators all standing on the floor, sort of jawboning each other and arm twisting going on to try and get the 60 votes they needed on that vote. And it sort of hung in the balance. Again, they needed one or two more Republican votes. And that's when McConnell particularly sort of led a small group of Republicans to come down and actually vote for the thing. That then puts it over the hurdle. Now we can bring the bill to the floor. And then, of course, when it comes time to pass the bill, that's only a 50-vote majority necessary. And all the Republicans go back to voting against it.
There was talk that someone like, say, Ted Cruz might actively filibuster, but it sounds more like a passive resistance. We're not blocking it, but we're not blocking it at the same time.
Yeah, and you know it's going to snow, right?
Right. I mean, well, there is that.
So, yeah, no, I mean, that's not really kidding. I mean,
right.
The matter is that the senators, like everybody else, want to get out of here and go home, and they had an agreement that we'll just go down, we'll have this vote, and then, presuming it passes, we will just move on and vote on the bill, because nobody wants to spend, you know, the next 5 days buried in a snowstorm in Washington, D.C. We want to go home.
So looking ahead on this thing, now it's going to pass. The debt ceiling is going to go up.
Yep.
Were we right? It's about a year before we'll have to talk about this again?
Yeah. It'll be a year before we have to talk about the debt ceiling. That's March 2015. You know, federal spending is still an issue because that deal expires in September. But it's hard to imagine, really, a major battle over keeping the government open 3 weeks or was it 6 weeks before an election. So you have to assume that one will be fairly easy to kick past the November elections. So we'll be doing neither debt nor spending for the rest of the year.
But this is a thing we keep coming back to again and again. It's put off for a year now. Is there any talk of doing this differently so we don't have to have these near or complete train wrecks every so often?
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk about that in the past couple of months. Even, in fact, I believe it was a couple of years ago, the Senate had some language in a bill that passed that allowed the government to raise the debt ceiling by itself for a brief period of time. One of the ideas is to reverse the burden here so that the administration, the White House, would be able to raise the debt ceiling on its own with giving Congress the right to veto that with a vote against it. That would still give Congress the power to say no, but it wouldn't require them to make a painful vote to say yes. But, you know, it's just really hard to do stuff like that and to pass legislation like that because, again, the Republicans will say, well, we don't trust the Obama administration. And then once there's a Republican president, the Democrats will say, well, we don't trust the Republican administration. It's just hard to get that kind of change in place. But it's possible because I think there's enough frustration and concern. And even now among Republicans, they didn't really like the way this whole thing played out. They ended up getting nothing.
So they're done with the debt ceiling. Now what do they have to do for the rest of the year?
Oh, well, there's plenty of vacations to take. not much. I mean, a strong case could be made that the competitive portion of this legislative season is over. They want to do immigration. There's been a lot of talk about immigration, but Republicans have already started suggesting that they're not going to do it this year because, again, they don't trust Obama to enforce the law. There's maybe some NSA reforms that they're going to try to do. There's, you know, a handful of other bills that will probably come along a pass, but I honestly think that there's nothing else that is must pass until we get to September and we got to keep the government open. So that's one of the reasons I declare Boehner a winner in my little column this afternoon, because now they can just turn the floor over to making political points, not necessarily legislating.
And nobody's going to do anything really big and dramatic, do you think, in an election year?
Well,
never know, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the part of the issue is no one's going to do anything bipartisan. And if you want to do anything big and dramatic, it usually helps to have other people on your side. And I don't expect that to happen at this point. Now, again, I don't discount the possibility of bolt of lightning on any topic, right? I mean, if there is, you know, God forbid we need $50 billion worth of bailout money for Georgia after today's storms, you know, something like that, well, that's when Congress usually comes together in a bipartisan fashion, moves some sort of a bill. But I'm not, at this moment, we are really scratching our heads. They finish these bills, they're off next week, it's 2 weeks before they're back in session at all, and they don't want to do immigration particularly at this moment. So we're not really sure what they take up next.
Well, you mentioned that weather that you've got coming, the storm, the ice storm expected in Atlanta. And the Senate today is holding a panel on extreme weather preparedness and what the federal government can do about it. What led to this happening?
You know, part of what led to it, I believe, was the headlines out of Georgia last week. Mm-hmm. But it's also something they've been working on for a while. They had a GAO has done some studies on this. This gets back to goes back to Katrina, really, and this discussion has been going on that we don't plan well for disasters, and we allow people to build in stupid places, and we are careless about protecting our infrastructure, and we don't really notice it until it gets knocked over by a windstorm, and then the whole country floods in billions of dollars to rebuild it all until it gets knocked over in the next storm. And I think this is part of what this committee was trying to get at, is there a way to do this better? And their numbers, and I'm just calling the story back up here, they said it was $1.5 trillion in economic losses between 1980 and 2010 due to poor preparation for emergency weather. And they think it's another $1 trillion in the next 10 or 15 years if we don't do better by, like, you know, strengthening our housing codes or redoing our flood maps or being more cautious about where we build and how we build in weather or disaster areas.
Is this just a mental exercise on this Senate committee's part or panel's part, or do you think something might actually come from this?
It is, I think, mostly a mental exercise. I mean, they have been revising flood insurance, the National Flood Insurance Program, over the past few years to make the flood insurance costs reflect the real risks of where you live. That's probably a benefit, although even that, it ended up hitting so hard on particularly Florida and a couple other places that all of a sudden their flood insurance rates are going through the roof, that Congress is now backpedaling and trying to sort of ease in those cost increases. There are things that the federal government is trying to do, the Senate and Congress are trying to do, to rebalance the way we reward risky behavior. but it's hard to do. There's, you know, everybody's got an interest in, you know, I don't want people building on the Outer Banks, North Carolina, until I buy my beach house there, and then I want everyone to build out there, and I want to be insured for being out there. Just kind of the way it works.
And I have, just briefly, have words like climate change or global warming been thrown around?
Yeah. Yeah, the part of the hearing today was about how climate change makes that worse. If we're going into this period, as the meteorologists tell us we are, of more extreme weather, then the need to batten down the hatches becomes more serious. Again, if we're not prepared, it doesn't matter if it's not raining. But when it starts raining, and raining a lot, and raining a lot more, then we're going to be in trouble. And their argument is it costs a lot less to prepare than it does to repair.
Paul, good luck with your weather out there, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much, Rob. Take care.
That's Paul Singer, politics and Congress editor at USA Today. He joins us this time every week.
We're talking about the single life. A lot of single people ask themselves why they're still single, and there's an abundance of reasons out there.
Too picky, too needy, low self-esteem. That's just the tip of the iceberg of common reasons society gives single people as to why they aren't partnered already.
Our next guest says there's nothing wrong with single people, and society needs to recognize it as a valid choice instead of treating single people with condescension and explaining away the single life with a flip word like fabulous. Here's a clip from the HBO series Sex and the City about how marginalized single people can feel.
Are you telling me you haven't gotten those poor single you looks?
I hate those. Okay, yes, I have. I hate it when you're the only single person at a dinner party and they all look at you like you're a
loser,
leper,
or
exactly.
Clip there from Sex and the City. Our guest now is Sarah Eckel, author of It's Not You, 27 Wrong Reasons You're Single. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So Sex and the City, like we just heard, it does make the single life in New York especially look like this fizzy fun bomb of cocktails, art galleries, fashion. It's also where we sort of learn to pair up the single life with the word fabulous. But is there something wrong with always equating single life, especially for women, with the word fabulous?
Well, I think it's the always. It's the problem. Of course, there are lots of things about being single that's a lot of fun, and there is a certain amount of freedom that you get when you don't have to consult another party when you are traveling or deciding if you're going to move and things like that. So there's a lot of great things about being single, and there's a lot of ways that it is a lot of fun. My problem with the word fabulous is that it implies that if your life is ordinary, if you just have a decent job and a decent apartment, that's somehow not enough, that you've got to be able to present this extra level of excitement to your life that a married person wouldn't have to do. So that's where I think the condescension comes in, this idea that you have to be sort of a little bit something extra.
So does that provide, do you think, a level of pressure for single people that they can't just be single, they have to be single and extraordinary?
Yeah, there's something where when you're talking to somebody at a wedding or talking to family, that there's an impulse to assure people that that you're okay, that you have a happy life, and so there's a lot of I travel so much for work, or I'm so invested in my career, I'm out with a different guy every night. There's just a kind of impulse, and it comes, I think, on both sides from a nice place. The person who is trying to be assured just wants to know that you have a happy life. And when you're the person kind of giving the fabulous speech, you want to assure this person that that they don't have to worry, that you are happy.
Do you think there's a certain amount of envy, though, on the other side? Sometimes people get married and they sort of stop doing those things that they did before. Maybe they want a little bit of inspiration from single people.
Yeah, I think that there is something really cool about the way that single people really extend themselves out into the world. I was actually just talking, I'm married now, and I was talking to a friend. We were talking about winter, and I was saying that it was really kind of bringing me down, and she wasn't really having a problem with it, and we talked about it a little bit, and I realized, well, she's out every night. She's either volunteering at the local community theater, or she's got a voice lesson, and she's usually out at night, whereas I tend to be at home. So there is a thing where when you, or at least I have experienced myself, just now that I'm married, I don't quite extend myself into the world the way that I used to when I was single. And I think the reason that I don't like the word fabulous is that it's just, I don't think it's enough to describe someone as fabulous, because single people also do quite a bit of community service, and they have been found, a study by sociologist Naomi Gerstel found that singles are actually more likely to help out friends and family and with household tasks or other things than married people are. So I think that there's just the kind of respect that needs to be shown to singles who are going out in the world and making the community a better place.
How acceptable do you think it is to be single now?
How difficult?
How acceptable in society?
Oh, I think it's definitely getting much better all the time. And I think that Sex and the City, you had that clip at the beginning. Sex and the City was great because it really marked the first time when people started really seem to be acknowledging that it can be, that being single can be a lot of fun, and that it isn't something where people have to be pitied, that there's just a lot to love about being single. So I think that that is great. What I'm sort of wanting to add to the conversation is that, yes, it can be a lot of fun and really wonderful, but it's also more than that. And if you are a single person who is undergoing a difficult time, maybe taking care of a family member who is ill, or just perhaps you've been laid off, or, you know, the single people have the same kind of challenges that married people have. So I just wanted to present the idea that single people are a lot more complex than just this sort of party girl. But I do think that people are definitely starting to understand that, and it's become a lot easier than it was certainly even 10 or 15 years ago.
Well, how would you like to see people relating to the single people in their lives, the people around them? That isn't sort of the monochromatic way that we've been talking about, the sort of, oh, you're single and fabulous, or single and sad is another. But what is the way just to, you know, meet on a common human-to-human basis? What's the right way to be?
Well, I think that I study Buddhism a lot, and the thing I think that's really interesting about it is the fact that Buddhism really embraces the fact that we all have many different experiences, sometimes even in the span of a day, sometimes even in the span of an hour. So sometimes life is fabulous, and sometimes it's sad, and sometimes it's a lot of hard work, and sometimes it's quite easy. And this is something that both singles and married people, of course, experience, and that there's no need to really to color anybody with one brush, because we all, throughout our days and weeks and months, we all, our lives are many different things. So I think that the main thing is to just embrace the fact that that a single person, just like a married person, is experiencing the whole gamut of wonderful times and difficult times, and to perhaps also, instead of trying to sort of label somebody like, oh, she's fabulous, or oh, she's so sad, instead just kind of just ask and maybe pay a little bit more attention rather than trying to kind of put somebody in a box right away.
We're talking right now to Sarah Eccles. She's the author of the new book called It's Not You, 27 Reasons You're Single.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you single? When you're talking to family or friends who are married, do you feel pressure, pity, envy, maybe? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email, talk@wpr.org.
We're talking now with Sarah Eccles. She's the author of It's Not You, 27 Wrong Reasons You're Single. We're talking about why our guest says it's time to give single people respect.
And you can join the show. Are you single? What's your experience like? Do you ask yourself, why am I single? Do you feel like you have to justify your singleness to yourself or others? Give a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
And so I want to ask you, we've been talking a lot about women, Sex in the City. It was a clip about four women friends in New York. There are men who pop up now and then. But is the experience different for single men?
You know, I receive a lot of letters from men who say that it's quite similar in terms of experiencing the same kind of loneliness and the same kind of frustration with finding someone. I think the differences are, one, a lot of men said that they don't have the same comfort of having female friends to talk to, or you know, same-sex friends to discuss this with. So on one hand, they have that to deal with. On the other hand, I don't think, I was talking to a man who's single recently, and he said that no one really, people assume that it's just his choice to be single, and that there isn't quite the sense of pity or this idea that he wasn't chosen by someone. It's more assumed that it's a choice.
We're talking about being single in our society today, and why our guest thinks that we should see single people as complete whole people and not just people leading, say, fabulous lives. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And let's go to Kathy in Rice Lake next. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a comment. I know being single, you know, is fine in the 30s and 40s and so, but as a person, you know, as you age, then, and you're single, and if you do not have a close-knit family or if you're in a city or so forth, you really do, you know, end up being alone. You know, at the end, if there is no one to care for you or to care about you as you're aging. And I just wanted to make that comment that, you know, that part of it is kind of sad, you know, for people to think that they're going into that period of their life without, you know, support and family, you know, maybe sons or daughters and so forth.
Well, Kathy, thank you so much for calling and sharing your thoughts. Sarah, what about the later years of a person's life who's single? Does it have to be what Kathy described?
I don't know that it necessarily has to be that way, because so many people do stay single for so long that they are able to have, they can form really deep friendship networks. So I'm not so sure that it's that way so much anymore. And as I said, single people really are good at finding communities and finding each other. So, yes, there might not be children around or a spouse. You know, now that I have a spouse, I can see it is a great support. But there are more than one ways to find that support.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call. And getting to your book, you broaden this out a little bit. You talk about the myths surrounding being single, and we mentioned some of those a while back, of being too picky, too independent. What are some of those things that still persist today?
I think the too picky thing, that was something that when I asked women what their friends and family said, was the reason that they were single. The feedback that they got from friends and family, it was most commonly that they were too picky, which is in some ways a compliment. It's saying, well, there are plenty of people who want to be with you. It's just that you're just choosing not to be with them. So there's a way in which it's a compliment, but it also, I could never really understand that comment, because it seems to me that a spouse is something you should absolutely be picky about. I don't think that women, you know, the women that I spoke to, they didn't care about what kind of car the person drove or how, what kind of, you know, the job or the car. It wasn't as superficial as that. It was more just a sense of, do I feel connected to this person? Am I attracted to this person? Is this someone I want to spend the rest of my life with? Which I think that someone should absolutely needs to pass that bar.
There's been a lot more discussion in culture recently about being alone, both people who live alone and how that can be an enriching, socially connected way to live your life, and also the single life, like you're writing about. And some people have made the observation that being single is sort of one of the last areas in which it's okay to discriminate against, that it's okay to sort of talk smack against people who are single, because it's sort of seen as a lighter thing that isn't really meant. Do you agree with that? Are single people discriminated against?
Yeah, well, it's as Bella DiPaolo has pointed out, it's not just a matter of just kind of, well, snide comments. It's actually written into the law. For example, with the Family and Medical Leave Act, if a single person falls ill, the only people who are legally entitled to take off work to care for that person would be her parents. If she doesn't have children, adult children, then those are the only people that are qualified: spouses, adult children, and parents. So even if she had a niece or a best friend or a sister who was willing to take off work to care for her, the law says that that they would not be legally entitled to do that. And also Social Security benefits, they go to a spouse. You can't decide if you're unmarried to give your Social Security benefits to somebody else. So there's a lot of things that are actually discrimination that's actually written into the law.
Let's take another phone call now. We've got Tim joining us from Tumberland. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay, how about you?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This bit about being single, okay? I'm going through my third and final divorce right now. I just turned 60. And, yes, I do have family and around me. But I can't see me holing up into, you know, my house or a hotel, you know, an apartment or something like that. I'm a disabled veteran, you know, from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I've made it this far. I'm in a wheelchair now and everything. And to me, the 60 is the new 45. Let's get out there and have some fun.
Okay.
The thing is there's a lot of single women, either divorced or widowed. But there is not that many free men. We're not a easy commodity.
So you think it's easier to...
I can afford to be picky.
Okay, well, sounds like you've got your fun going on there, Tim. Thank you so much. And Tim is optimistic about his prospects ahead and going into those later years. What do you think about that, Sarah?
Well, again, I think that as people get older, I think that the other thing that happens is that once people have grown children, I think it's a lot easier for single people and married people to spend time together. I think that, and this is something that Aaron Kleinenberg noted, which is that a big time that people lose friendships or friendships kind of become more challenging is when people have small children and they sort of they become so overwhelmed with that they lose touch with friends who don't have kids. So I think that in some ways the 60s are a great time to socialize and to reconnect with people because people are much more, you know, they're not caring for small children.
And the way that relationships and marriage works today, I mean, a lot of people move in and out of relationships. There can mm-hmm. be a fluidity about it. You might be coupled one moment and single the next. Is that making it easier, do you think, for those periods of singleness for everybody?
Yeah, I think so. And it also makes it clear that, you know, we're not any one thing. I think it's easy to identify really heavily with I am a single woman or I am a married woman. But most of us are both of those things in our life. And at one point, you're single and then you're married. And then either from death or divorce, you might be single again. So I think it's a lot more fluid. And there doesn't have to be such a heavy sense of identity to it. Whereas in the past, if someone was single past 30, that just... She's much more just branded as single for life, period. But now I think that it's just a lot more fluid.
Sarah, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great fun.
That was Sarah Eckel, author of the new book, It's Not You, 27 Wrong Reasons You're Single. She was with us to talk about how to treat the decision to be single with respect in our society.